Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, September 29th. MISD raises pay for substitutes. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. In an attempt to fill vacancies at Midland ISD campuses across the city, the district announced the increase of pay for substitute teachers. The raise comes as part of the recent update to the district's compensation manual, which was approved by the Board of Trustees at September's meeting, according to the district in a press release. The district reported that the baseline pay for regular substitutes will increase 33% from $90 a day to $120 a day. The new pay rates will go into effect October 1st. Substitute teachers that have worked more than 30 days will see their rates go up to $135. Those working more than 90 days will be paid a rate of $150. Other pay increases for substitutes include increases for regular teaching subs, substitute nurses, substitute clerical positions, teacher assistants, and those working in long-term assignments. Quote, maintaining a competitive rate of pay for all of our staff, including substitute teachers, is critical to our goal of providing a safe and high-quality education to all students, said Woodrow Bailey, Chief of Human Capital Management, in a press release. Quote, substitutes are vital to the successful operation and management of any school district. They play a crucial role in the staffing puzzle of any district, and this increase shows that we value their role within Midland ISD, end quote. Full-day substitute teacher, regular, $120. After 30 cumulative days, regardless of location, $135. After 90 cumulative days, regardless of location, $150. Full-day nurse schedule, regular, $160. After 30 cumulative days, regardless of location, $170. After 90 cumulative days, regardless of location, $180. Full-day clerical technical teacher assistant substitute, regular, $100. Long-term FMLA, full-day substitute teachers, 25 or more consecutive days in the same assignment. Long-term degree teacher certified, $312. FMLA long-term subs, $312. Retired long-term subs, $332. Long-term degreed, $250. Long-term non-degreed, $200. Long-term full-day clerical technical teacher assistant substitute, regular, $110. Long-term, $115. Retired long-term, $125. How to apply? MidlandISD.net/substitute. UTPB reports largest freshman class ever. The story was written by Ben Schaffer. The University of Texas Permian Basin announced its largest freshman class ever for the fall semester in a press release Wednesday. UTPB reported 615 freshmen, 10% more than the previous high set in the fall semester of 2020, according to the press release. The university reported that overall enrollment has increased 3.8% to 5,713 students. Quote, it's so rewarding to welcome both the largest freshman class and the highest number of transfer students ever to the university, UTPB President Sandra Woodley stated in the release. The university reported that nearly half of the school's undergraduate population have been awarded Falcon Free, a university program that covers tuition and mandatory educational fees for 4 years. UTPB has distributed $12.6 million in grants and scholarships. At a glance, the University of Texas Permian Basin detailed their total enrollment success for this fall semester, which includes student credit hours up 7.5%, undergraduates up 7%, graduate students up 3%, first-time college students up 43%, and transfer students up 36%. ConocoPhillips to provide lift for small startups, entrepreneurs. The story was written by Ben Schaffer. Lupi Mares, vice president of the Southwest Region for Lift Fund, a San Antonio loan agency, detailed ConocoPhillips' Small Biz Builder program Wednesday morning at ConocoPhillips' office. She spoke to Midland small business owners at the ConocoPhillips office to discuss small business growth and development and how this program can help. Lift Fund helps startups and entrepreneurs with funding, tools, and resources. ConocoPhillips' Small Biz Builder program is a virtual informational training program. Quote, "This, again, is funding we've received from ConocoPhillips to help us do this program," Morris said. The course consists of 3 training sessions that include one-on-one business consultations and special loan consideration through Lift Fund. Once small business owners looking for funds apply with Lift Fund, they are placed into tiers based on credit, experience, and other factors. Participation in the Small Biz Builder program can boost a business owner's chances of receiving loans. To submit an online application for the program, visit ConocoPhillips.com/ConocoPhillips Small Biz Builder. The deadline to apply is 11:59 p.m. October 7. Quote, "Our goal is for you all to leave us. We want to lose our best customers so you can go back to your bank or your credit union. We are just a stepping stone," Morris said. At a glance, what? Small Biz Builder Program. Who? ConocoPhillips and Lift Fund. Deadline, 11:59 p.m. October 7th. Apply, ConocoPhillips.com/ConocoPhillips-Small-Biz-Builder. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, September 29th. Hazel Colleen Church Leonard, age 97, of Midland, passed away on Monday, September 26. Colleen was born in Colorado City, Texas, to Steve and Lois Church on July 16, 1925. Carl Leonard Jr., known as Hoot, and Colleen married in an elopement ceremony during World War II in 1942. She passed away on Hoot's birthday. They were married 76 years. She is survived by her immediate family, Jackie and Bruce Carter, Gail and Dennis Stratton, Don and Phyllis Leonard, Guy and Beverly Leonard, Elaine Leonard, and Joanne and Randy Klinkhammer. A public visitation for Colleen will be held Thursday, September 29th from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the new facility, Alice Resthaven Funeral Home, 4616 North Big Spring Street, Midland. A funeral service will occur Friday, September 30th at 2 p.m., followed by a graveside service at 4616 North Big Spring Street in Midland. Fond memories and expressions of sympathy may be shared at www.ellisfunerals.com for the Leonard family. The family asks that any memorial gifts or donations be directed to Hospice of Midland. Louis Cecil Hobbs, also known as LC, passed away at the age of 97 on Tuesday, September 27. Mr. Hobbs was born on August 30, 1925, and was a lifelong resident of Midland. He attended Midland High School and proudly served in the United States Navy during World War II. Mr. Hobbs is survived by his wife of nearly 74 years, Evelyn Caffey Hobbs, and three children, Elaine Kasperik and husband Gary of Pontotoc, Texas, Bill Hobbs and wife Liz of Midland, and Nancy Davis and husband Wayne of Fort Worth. Additional family members include four grandchildren, along with several great-grandchildren and numerous other relatives. Mr. Hobbs was employed at the Midland Map Company for several decades, with much of that time spent as manager of the reproduction department. A graveside service for Mr. Hobbs will be held on Friday, September 30th at 1 p.m. at the Rest Haven Memorial Park, located at 4616 North Big Spring Street, preceded by a visitation time on Thursday, September 29th, from 5 until 7 p.m. at the Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Mary Ann Surgo passed away on September 16th following a stroke. She was born on January 11, 1930, in New Orleans, Louisiana, to Sicilian immigrants. She married Manuel Al Surgo, Jr. on September 30, 1950, and moved with him through his career with Texaco to New Iberia, Louisiana, back to New Orleans, then to Midland and Houston. After her husband retired, they moved back to Midland to watch their grandchildren grow up. She was preceded in death by her husband, her parents, and her five older brothers, Joe, Philip, Benny, Sal, and Vic. She is survived by her five children, Sharon, Manny, Victor, Brian, and Eric, as well as 13 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to her favorite charity, St. Jude Children's Hospital, or Midland Montessori School in Midland. A funeral service for Mary will be held Saturday, October 1st at 10 a.m. at Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home, 4616 North Big Spring Street, Midland. Burial will follow at 11 a.m. Phyllis Capadonna Short passed away unexpectedly on Friday, September 23rd, after a brief illness. She was born on December 27, 1947, in Port Arthur, Texas, to Margaret and Philip Capadonna. The family moved to Midland, Texas, when Phyllis was 6 years old. She attended St. Anne's Catholic Church. She attended St. Anne's Catholic School and graduated from Lee High School in 1965. She and her husband taught school in Eagle Pass, Texas, before moving back to Midland in 1971, where her husband joined the family's business, Midwest Electric Company. Phyllis is preceded in death by her parents and sister Jean Capadonna Nichols. Survivors include her husband of 52 years, John, daughter Gina Short Friedman, and son-in-law Ben of Midland, several grandchildren, brother John Capadonna and wife Jane of Midland, and numerous nieces, nephews, and great-nieces and nephews. Phyllis was a member of First Baptist Church of Midland, where her memorial service will be held Friday, September 30th at 10 a.m. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that memorials be directed to Bynum School, 5100 Avalon Drive, Midland, or an organization of choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. To send online condolences, please visit www.npwelch.com. Johnny Lee Emberlin of Midland died on September 26th in Midland. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, October 1st, at American Heritage Funeral Home. Interment to follow in Jefferson, Texas, on Monday, October 3rd. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland.
Good morning. This is Kim. I'm reading the Odessa American, and today's date is Thursday, September 29th. Firefighter pay, a hot topic, at city meeting. White says some council members are using firefighters as pawns. Impatient that the city of Odessa still hasn't received the results of a compensation study for first responders, council members Denise Swanner and Mark Mata pushed to give members of the Odessa Fire Rescue immediate raises Tuesday night, but the motion failed 4-3. All seven members of the city council voted July 26th to hire an outside firm to look at how all city employees are paid in comparison to other municipalities before discussing potential raises. The council also agreed the firm should give priority to studying the OFR, the Odessa Police Department, and emergency dispatchers. The decision was made after firefighters filled the council chambers multiple times, pleading for help and blaming low pay for the departure of 35 employees last year and the department's seeming inability to attract new firefighters. Tuesday night, it was announced the department is on track to lose even more this year. 30 have left so far, and 13 of them have left since the outside firm was hired. With the firefighters again filling the council chambers, Swanner told her fellow council members she thought it was their duty to stop the bleeding. Swanner made a motion to raise new firefighters' starting salary by 22% to $65,823, to give captains a 15% raise, division captains a 12% raise, and battalion chiefs an 8% raise. The total cost could be covered by the city's American Rescue Plan Act money, she said. ARPA funds are not a recurring annual fund. I don't believe in waiting on the study. We're losing guys right and left, and we need to do something about it, Swanner said. After learning the outside consultant is expected to offer its recommendation on October 11th, council members Deitra White, Tom Sprawls, Mary Willis, and Steve Thompson voted against Swanner's motion, which was seconded by Mata and got Mayor Javier Hoven's vote. During the hour-long discussion prior to the vote, OFR Chief John Alvarez listed each of the reasons the 30 firefighters gave for leaving, and 8 definitively said it was due to pay. The chief said he absolutely agrees. His crews need raises, but he railed against the false narrative that is being spread that the department has morale issues and that he doesn't support his staff. While there may be small pockets of low morale, he's not heard about it, he said. There's a narrative that's being pushed out there that there's a morale issue, and after you say it a few times, people are probably going to believe that, Alvarez said. Do they want a raise? Absolutely, they want a raise, and I know that's what's been their biggest issue. I've explained to you what I've done as a fire chief. I've been ridiculed on OAP, Odessa Accountability Project. False information has been thrown out there. I mean, my God, I've been put on Facebook on the OAP as Pinocchio, and you know what? I don't appreciate that. Alvarez also said something else is stirring up the department. It's the slander and the attacks on this administration that's what's causing this. People are seeing us being attacked. You're attacking our department, whether you think you're doing the right thing or not. That's where our problems begin, Alvarez said. Just days after celebrating his 30-year anniversary with the department, Alvarez said he has a huge problem seeing how things are being run. Specifically, Alvarez said members of the OFR Association have been meeting with council members without involving OFR leadership or city manager Michael Marrero. I'm telling you, to me it's embarrassing. I have this entire department back here, standing here begging for a raise here. You know, there's different ways of doing things, Alvarez said. Alvarez said he was asked by a member of the OFR Association whose side he was on, Marrero's or the department's. He said the question made as much sense as asking someone to choose between their wife and their children. Hoven asked Alvarez what his response was, prompting Willis to tell Alvarez he didn't have an answer. Alvarez said it was a dangerous question, but he said he works for Marrero and the department. But when I'm being sidestepped about this pay as a leader, that's a problem, Alvarez said. It's also a problem that OFR was on the council's agenda, and yet no one told him what it was about, he said. White agreed with Alvarez that Swanner and Mata should not have met with members of the OFR Association, prompting Swanner to interrupt and say, if they, in my opinion, if things had been done properly, the association would never have come to us to begin with, and they were constituents, so I addressed it. I have a duty to this council and a duty to the women and men that protect our city. White said she understands Swanner's point of view, but noted she's never addressed any of this stuff. I don't believe I owe it to you, Swanner said, interrupting her again. White went on to note the city council agreed to wait for the consultant's report before addressing compensation. She pointed out dispatchers have also made a passionate plea for raises. But guess what? We've got everyone in the city, and they are your constituents, too, White said. We've got everyone in the city, and we're not going around behind their backs. We're behind Michael's back and meeting with different groups and agencies trying to backdoor something as critical as this. Swanner said if they were trying to backdoor something, they wouldn't be having the discussion. White said the decision on raises is a business one, and the city has to find the money somewhere. There are people in the city wondering if the OFR is going to get a 22% raise while they get nothing, she said. Mata pointed out the city recently opened a new fire station and agreed to spend $3.2 million on new fire engines and a ladder truck. He asked what good those things will do residents if there aren't any firefighters left to staff the stations or operate the trucks. Thompson sided with White, saying personnel issues ought to be settled between OFR's leadership and Marrero. Sprouls questioned why the matter was being brought up again after a discussion was made to wait back in July, and Willis pointed out the police department and dispatchers are equally important, and yet they've not reached out to Swanner and Mata. I think this is totally out of place, uncalled for. It's just a classic example of micromanagement, Thompson said. Following the vote, Thompson said, we're setting a terrible precedent here tonight on how we run the city of Odessa. It's very scary. Next time I come here, we'll have all of the police department here. The next meeting, we'll have all of the administration. The next meeting, we'll have the whole sanitation department, and the next, we'll have the whole water department up here. This is not the way to run a business. OFR firefighter paramedic Nick Sharp reminded the council of what they've been told before. Firefighters are leaving the department for other municipalities that pay more, including Pecos, Lubbock, and Reeves County. He spoke of a 14-year veteran who just left the department in tears because he felt unappreciated and was having suicidal thoughts. OFR firefighter paramedic Josh Heron said thanks to current staffing levels, essentially one firefighter is responsible for covering the equivalent of 15 square miles, and it's only going to get worse. Are we going to get to the point where we have to drop staffing? Brown out stations? How do you choose which stations you're going to brown out? Which neighborhood is more important and which neighborhood is less important? Heron said, how do we do that? How do we look at 175,000 people in the face and say, your neighborhood is not important? The OFR Association wasn't organized when he reached out to Mata and Swanner, and he found it hurtful when Alvarez accused him of sidestepping. I was concerned. I simply asked, what can we do to help our fire department stop bleeding? And this is where we are. So by no means was I trying to sidestep anybody or overstep any boundaries or do anything negative to make a negative impact or negative image on this fire department, Heron said. Council member-elect Chris Haney told the council there shouldn't even be an argument. They should give the firefighters raises immediately. Odessa Development Corporation board member Chris Crow said his conversations with firefighters have been in stark contrast to the conversations Alvarez described to the council. He insisted there are morale issues within OFR, and he said he has yet to attend a meeting or read minutes where OFR brass brought up raises. So, Mr. Thompson, to answer your question, when your direct supervisors don't do anything, you have got to have a way to go around them and get your questions answered, Crow said. Crow asked the council how many firefighters could be funded with the $1 million being spent on a public art project by the city. We've got to get our priorities right. We've got to get back to the infrastructure, police officers, firefighters, road, water. Parks are nice. I love parks. That's great. But you know what? I'd rather dial 911 and have somebody answer and be there on the other end, Crow said. Following the meeting, White said she believes Swanner, Monta, and Hoven were using the firefighters as pawns in some sort of a political game. If this was a really sincere effort to get this through, why do they meet secretly? They sent us nothing. Nothing to look at or to take into consideration. They don't involve staff to see what we can do financially, White said. Any pay increases would not be just a one-time deal. The city would have to be able to sustain them going forward, White said. The ARPA funding mentioned by Swanner during the meeting as a way to fund raises is not an annual fund. White, who spent 23 years as a fire marshal within the OFR, has taken the whole thing personally. It's my department. Looking at their faces, they are so mad because there was such an expectation that this was going to be done last night, White said. Denise, Mark, and Javier concocted this thing, but they were the only ones that knew what was going to be presented. I just feel like they're playing a political game, and they're using those firefighters as pawns. White said she wants the firefighters to know they are appreciated, but the council has to look at the big picture and take into consideration all city employees, including those on the lower end of the pay scale who may be struggling to put food on the table. The council has to worry about compression, too. They can't have fewer employees taking more than their supervisors, which is another reason city staff has to be brought into the discussion, she said. I made it home before I started to cry because they were taking my department from me and turning those men and women against me. And I would give anything for them, but I will do the right thing, White said. OC announces $1 million FBCU donation. A standing room only crowd welcome News Wednesday of a $1 million donation from First Basin Credit Union to Phase 2 of the James Segrest Stadium. The announcement, attended by OC staff and officials and First Basin Credit Union executives and staff, was made in the foyer of the Salisbury Campus Center. Vice President of Advancement Jackie Gore said the track is expected to open in spring 2024. Officials said it also signals return of the OC track program. Gore said ground was broken for the track September 30, 2021. We launched our capital campaign last October, and we completed the new turf field in Blue Track in early 2022. So I know all of you have driven by and seen how great that looks. We have continued to work on the fundraising efforts to start Phase 2 of the project, which includes a ticket office, stands on both sides of the field, fencing around the stadium, pavilion, and seating for the athletes, and an outdoor fitness facility, Gore said. The fitness facility will be open to the public, she added. JSA architects have been working on details for the stadium and been waiting for word on when to get started. Thanks to a very generous contribution, we can now move forward with Phase 2 of this project, Gore said. Gore said OC will acknowledge the contribution by including the First Basin Credit Union logo as the exclusive financial institution of the James Segrist Stadium. The First Basin Credit Union logo and branding will be included on the Tobe-constructed scoreboard, East and West Side stands, and the new outdoor fitness facility, Gore said. She added that First Basin is a strong community partner and OC is excited to work with them on this important project. First Basin Credit Union President and CEO Shem Culpepper said they are a staunch supporter of Odessa College, and they are very proud of that. He added that the project is important to the growth and visibility of the college. An athletic program is important to the growth and visibility of a college, and with a lack of the track and field program, we felt there was a great opportunity to jump in and provide the resources to give a kind of jump start and get this program off the ground, Culpepper said. He noted that First Basin is pretty selective on who it partners with. First Basin, he said, shares a lot of the same values with Odessa College. The benefit is that it enables us to reach the community and show our support for the entire community. Odessa College is such an important part of the community, it seems natural that our association with them will satisfy both of those goals, Culpepper said. Culpepper added that OC has touched the lives of countless people. First Basin has a program that encourages employees to earn associate degrees. Culpepper said he has 4 children, all of whom took advantage of OC's dual credit program. OC's dual credit program is absolutely a godsend for many, many, many families in the Permian Basin. My family is one of those, Culpepper said. He added that 3 of his 4 children went on to earn their undergraduate and graduate degrees at Texas Tech University. The 4th one is in her final year of her undergraduate program. So to say that the dual credit program at OC is a success is a huge understatement, and I thank you guys, Culpepper said. He added that First Basin has been successful in the past and has articles and posters to prove it. But they also look to the future, Culpepper said. First Basin wants to share in the vision of OC, continue to expand and be an integral part of the Permian Basin. First Basin Chief Marketing Officer Tim O'Reilly said this has been in the works for about 6 months. O'Reilly said this agreement represents 2 great organizations are coming together. Gore said not only will First Basin's donation help build James Segrist Stadium, but it will help bring track and field back to Odessa College. Athletic Director Wayne Baker said he first became acquainted with Segrist and Odessa College in the 1980s. At that time, they were in an historic run. We have over 60 national championships at Odessa College historically, and 11 of them came in track and field. The most impressive thing about Coach Segrist, besides the fact that he's a wonderful person and a wonderful gentleman, is the fact that he won 11 national championships, Baker said. He added that there are indoor and outdoor national championships, which allowed Segrist to win multiple championships in the same year. Baker added that OC was very dominant in all sports in the 1970s and 80s. They had a little financial disaster in the 90s that it won't bring up again, and it caused some programs to be dropped. That was before most of our times. I can't really address that other than knowing that it occurred. What we're doing right now is to not only restore the program to national prominence in track and field, but also to use a very, very fine gentleman's name in the process. I know James personally, and I know that he's very proud of it, Baker said. OC President Gregory Williams said the stadium is going to be elegant, impactful, and it's going to be part of saving lives like everything else that we do. Gore said the capital campaign is still in full force. We're going to raise another $2 million to complete the James Segrist Stadium, she added. ECISD Creating Counselor Diagnostician Pipeline. Stemming from a need for counselors and diagnosticians Ector County ISD has set up pipelines with local and regional universities to grow their own. Right now, we have an agreement with UTPB for a diagnostician pipeline, and we are in the final stages. It hasn't been board approved yet, but we're in the final stages of developing an agreement with Sol Ross for diagnosticians as well. So we'll have two ways in which we can certify diagnosticians, get them the credentials. Executive Director of Talent Development Ashley Osborne said, a counseling pipeline also has been set up through Angelo State University. Executive Director of Counseling Chelsea Reyes said. Osborne noted that the pipeline efforts are grant and foundation funded. The district is either trying to pay their salary for the internship year or their tuition and fees. Executive Director of Guidance, Counseling, and Wellness, Chelsea Reyes, said there are 6 elementary school counseling openings, and 2 of those are on the ones at Downing and Fly that are additional openings. Wilson and Young Medal of Honor Middle School and Bowie Middle School each have 1. Osborne said there are 6 employees in the counseling pathway, and 4 that will be in the diagnostician pipeline. Osborne said having several universities involved means ECISD can have multiple pathways so people can acquire credentials. The district also pays for their bachelor's and master's degrees. Chelsea actually did the legwork to review and meet with a lot of potential partners. Angelo State just has the best fit for our needs, and they had experience in running a cohort model, which is what we are really interested in doing because that's just another layer of support for the candidates that are seeking that master's degree and certification, Osborne said. Having a group of people taking the same track can help create a network, which she said offers more support. Osborne said the courses are offered online. Reyes said one of the reasons Angelo State was selected was their experience, but also that the program is online. After 1 year of the program, they receive an intern certification. Once they receive the intern certification, we will be able to hire them on as school counselor interns to help fill some of the vacancies, Reyes said. Interns are still going through their practicums. Part of their practicum is the requirement of the hours, counseling services, and mental health counseling piece. School counselors have teaching backgrounds, so they're able to provide all of the other services as far as guidance lessons, responsive services, individual planning, and the mental health component really is what the internship is for, Reyes said. Reyes said additional positions are added to the largest elementaries, 2 of which are E.K. Downing and Murray Fly. Osborne said one of the barriers to becoming a counselor or diagnostician is finances. Us being able to provide support in terms of tuition and fees, and then also the support of the cohort model, ensures more that our team members will be more successful in their pursuit of that credential, whether it be a master's in counseling or what have you, and that more people are able to pursue those opportunities because we removed that financial barrier. That's the trend that you'll see in all of our pipelines is compensation or that financial aspect, Osborne said. She added that they want to give counselors and diagnosticians a top-notch foundation because they don't just want people filling jobs. We want them to have high-quality preparation and to be ready to take on that position before they actually do, and then get them placed where they'll be the best fit. Candidates also work with ECISD in job-embedded professional learning for 1 year to understand what it means to take on the counselor or diagnostician position, she added. Reyes said they surveyed counselors to see where they attended college so they could find out what schools were feeding into ECISD. We interviewed the top 3 university programs that we had. I believe it was UTPB, Sol Ross, and Angelo State. Those were the top 3 where our counselors were coming from. I know a lot of the barrier for some people is the requirement that courses be in person. That was the reason that we also chose this one, and then again, the fact that they offer the intern certification was a benefit to the student and to us, because if they want to counsel, they want to begin sooner rather than later, Rhea said. It's a 2-year program, whereas some other programs might be 2 to 3 years. Osborne said they are proud that their pipeline work involves departments from across the district. Misty Heiner is the Special Education Supervisor for ECISD. We continually have vacancies in the diagnostician position. Post-COVID, we've had a large influx of referrals for children to be tested for special ed. So to meet that need to try and make sure that they're all tested in a timely manner, we needed more people. So that's where we discussed the need for the diagnostician, Heiner said. ARD stands for Admission, Review, and Dismissal. Heiner said every other state calls it an IEP meeting, but in Texas, they call it an ARD meeting. IEP stands for Individualized Education Program, and Heiner said you address the IEP through the ARD meetings. There's required people for the ARD committee. That's your diagnostician or evaluation personnel. So that can be the diagnostician or the ARD facilitator, a general ed teacher, special ed teacher, parent, and then an administrator for the campus. In addition to that, it depends on what services the kids are afforded. Like if they receive adaptive PE, then there's an adaptive PE person. Anybody that does related services will also be in those meetings, Heiner said. She added that there are 5 openings right now. This is her 5th year in her position, and they have never been fully staffed with diagnosticians. Quick hits, free pizza. Little Caesar Love's Kitchen will be at the Odessa Salvation Army, 811 East 10th Street, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Friday, with free pizza for the hungry, homeless, and disaster victims. The company supplies the food and volunteers that allow 2 trucks to serve meals across the U.S. daily. COVID-19 Vaccine Clinic, the Ector County Health Department, 221 North Texas Avenue, has scheduled a back-to-school COVID-19 vaccine clinic for ages 6 months and older from 8 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. each Thursday throughout September. Visit tinyurl.com/54TSK5SK. Coffee and Community Conversation. Odessa College has scheduled an Hispanic Heritage event, Coffee and Community Conversation. Issues affecting the Hispanic community today, from noon to 1 p.m. September 29th on Facebook Live. Visit tinyurl.com/YDV5A5NE. Blood Drive, Odessa Family YMCA, 3001 East University Boulevard, has scheduled a blood drive from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. September 29th. To schedule an appointment, call Wendy Hilliard at 432-425-4001 or 877-25-VITAL, or visit donors.vitalent.org or odessayMCA.org. Use blood drive code 41440. The Ector County Library, 321 West 5th Street, has scheduled their Story Cubes Spooky Stories Children's Event from 5 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. September 29th. Story Cubes, paper, and pencils will be provided. To learn more, call Angela Gall at 432-332-0633, extension 2126, or email agaule@ector.lib.tx.us, or visit ector.lib.tx.us. Jurassic Grill, the Great American Steakout, presents Jurassic Grill, benefiting the Permian Basin Rehabilitation Center, from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. September 29th at La Hacienda Event Center, 12600 Highway 191 Midland. The event will include steak dinners complete with all the trimmings cooked by 18 local volunteer grillin' teams. There will also be a live and silent auction and live music by Tom Yankton. Donations are welcome. For tickets, tables, or more information, call 432-332-8244 or email jarellano@pbrehab.com or for table sales, email sadams@pbrehab.com or visit pbrehab.org. Solicitation of a minor trial begins. The trial of a 25-year-old Odessa man accused of arranging to meet a 14-year-old 4-6 earlier this year began Wednesday with a prosecutor and a DPS special agent reading texts exchanged between the defendant and the girl, who was really the special agent pretending to be an underaged girl. Special Agent Eric Waffles testified that in January, he and law enforcement officers from the Odessa Police Department and Reeves County Sheriff's Office set up a sting operation in the hope of arresting people intending to engage in human trafficking or sex crimes against children. He created a profile of an adult woman on social media and a dating app and waited for someone to respond. On January 12th, Waffles and Dakota Beal responded via the dating app, and within 3 hours, they began texting each other. The conversation was mainly about sex, which Beal brought up, he said. Early in the conversation, Waffles testified. Beal asked him, posing as the woman, if he wanted to be picked up. Waffles said he then told Beal he had a secret, that he was actually only 14. Waffles told Assistant Ector County Attorney Ricky Ernest that many times when he's undercover, the person he's texting with will immediately stop responding upon learning the girl he's texting is underage. In Beal's case, he asked for pictures of the girl. When he asked Beal what type, Beal said sexy pictures. Waffles testified. When he sent Beal a picture of a dark-haired girl, Beal, who said he was 17, asked if he had any naked pictures he could send. Waffles testified. Waffles and Ernest then read to the jurors the lengthy text exchange between the two that ultimately led to Beal being arrested one block from Crockett Middle School, where they had arranged to meet. At the time of Beal's arrest, he had methamphetamine in his possession. During the text exchange, Beal repeatedly asked Waffles for nude photos, and Waffles, continuing to pose as an underage girl, kept declining, saying things like she didn't want to disappoint him, that she was inexperienced, that her phone was linked with her mother's, and she didn't want to get into trouble. Beal kept insisting that he wasn't going to leave his house to meet her until he'd seen photos of her nude. Eventually, Waffles sent two pictures of a girl in shorts and a sports bra, photos of an adult woman that were actually obtained from a police database used specifically in such sting operations. Beal asked the girl if she was a virgin and if she wanted to change that. And when Waffles, playing along, said yes, but wasn't sure what to do, Beal texted, "I'll show you." Beal also asked the girl if she'd be willing to engage in specific sex acts. As the text conversation dragged out, Waffles repeatedly asked Beal if he was on his way, telling him she was cold waiting outside at Crockett. They also questioned each other as to whether the other person was real or not. At one point, Beal texted he'd been delayed while stopping to buy condoms and offered her $20 for waiting on him. When he finally arrived in the area of the school, Beal insisted she come out to the street so he could see her, and Waffles insisted he come into the parking lot and flash his headlights. Waffles also got Beal to describe his vehicle. Waffles said ultimately officers pulled Beal over a block from the school. He testified they had legal cause to pull Beal over because he had a malfunctioning license plate light. During cross-examination from defense attorney Kelsey Robbins, Waffles testified the administrators of the dating app deleted the profile he created for the sting operation before he could screenshot it, and he suspects it was because they truly thought the person was underage. he denied creating the profile in such a way as to entice men. Waples also denied he coerced or persuaded Beale to commit solicitation by asking Beale where he went when Beale went 15 minutes without responding to one of his texts. Nor was it coercion when he repeatedly texted Beale comments like, "Oh, you don't really want to see me, do you?" When Beale was dragging his feet about meeting up, Waples said, "The special agent agreed he's the one who set up where and when they could meet, but he explained that law enforcement officers need to vet the location in advance to ensure their safety and the safety of any children who might accidentally wander into the location and get picked up by the sexual predator they're trying to arrest." Waples conceded Beale never overtly said he believed the person he was texting was 14. Beale is charged with solicitation of a minor for sexual conduct and manufacturing, delivering of a controlled substance more than 4 grams, less than 200 grams. Judge Justin Lowe of the 161st Ector County District Court is presiding over the trial. Local news roundup. Grim Reaper investigated. A report of a man dressed like the Grim Reaper around Burnett Elementary School has been investigated by the Odessa Police Department. In a text message, OPD Public Relations Manager Monica Quintero said the OPD investigated the situation and continues to monitor it. At this time, she said there is no criminal activity. According to social posts, parents were alarmed and some pulled their children out of school or not taking them because of the man. There were also calls to the school. Accused burglar arrested in Odessa. An Odessa man was arrested on suspicion of burglary and arson Tuesday night after employees of a nightclub trapped him inside. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers received a 911 burglary in progress report from the location's lounge on Golder Avenue around 6:30 p.m. When officers arrived, 3 men said they trapped another man inside because he wasn't supposed to be there, the report stated. Officers found Sherman Merritt, 31, inside and without prompting him, said he'd broken into the building to look for food and water, according to the report. Officers also smelled something burning, found smoldering paper towels in a corner of the bar. Merritt said he'd burned them for a light source, the report stated. Merritt was booked into the Ector County Jail, and as of Wednesday afternoon, no bond had been set. Arson is a Class 2 felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. Burglary of a building is a state jail felony punishable by 6 to 2 years in prison. Man accused of assaulting officer. An attendee of West Texas Fest was arrested on multiple charges, including assault of a public servant. According to an Odessa Police Department report, an officer saw an apparently intoxicated Brett Williams Heinen using a table for balance at the event Saturday at 5th Street in Texas and became concerned because Heinen started to leave without a sober person to accompany him. Heinen picked up his pace when the officer tried to get him to stop. And when the officer ran after him, he pulled a wine bottle out of his hoodie pocket and began to run away while yelling what sounded like obscenities, the report stated. When another officer tackled Heinen, Heinen wrapped his arms around his neck, according to the report. He then pulled off the officer, but he continued to resist arrest, and it took a third officer to help to handcuff him. Heinen was taken to Medical Center Hospital for injuries he'd sustained during the altercation, and medical staff had to sedate him because he was fighting with them while they were trying to treat him, according to the report. Heinen was booked into the Ector County Jail Monday on suspicion of evading detention, assaulting a public servant, and resisting arrest. He was released Tuesday after posting surety bonds totaling $16,000. The assault charge is a Class 3 felony, punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison. Today's deaths for Thursday, September 29th. Sheila K. Thurman Weaver, 70, of Odessa, died Tuesday, September 13th, in Odessa. Memorial service is scheduled for 1 p.m. October 1st at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Jimmy Dennis is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Mike Fierro, Sr., 81, of Odessa, died Monday, September 26, in Odessa. Mass will be celebrated at 2 p.m. September 30th at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Father Frank Chavez is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Garden and Funeral Home of Odessa. Jimmy Lee Emberlin, 73, died Monday, September 26th in Midland. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.